This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. This afternoon, we've got two drastically different authors I'm going to be talking with. One is Alex Beam, the Boston Globe columnist I've talked with off and on for the last, 2 years, a little over 2 years. He's been working on his book, A Great Idea, at the time, and I've checked with him every now and then to see how it's been going. And the book's been out for about a month now, and it seems to be going quite well. We'll catch up on what's happening with him. And this is obviously a discussion of dead white males. In the second half of the program, we may be dealing with very alive Asian females. I'm going to be talking with journalist Leslie T. Chang about her book, Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China, which follows the lives of a number of young Chinese women who've gone from the countryside to work in immense Chinese factories. And along the way, she gives a lot of her own family history. And Alex, welcome back to Booktown.
Hey, Eric. Thank you very much for having me.
And I think you give a little bit of your family history in A Great Idea at the time. It was, for anyone who may not have heard some of the earlier interviews, it's The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. And you jump in a little bit on how you experienced the Great Books and also how your son did when he was attending Columbia College. He apparently didn't read very many of them.
Well, he claims that they imparted to him the skill on how to skim the Great Books adequately to sort of BS about them, I guess, in the weekly seminar.
And that's one of the things that I most enjoyed reading the book after talking with you about it for 2 years, was the personal reactions of some of the people who are still quite avid Great Books readers, even after the program itself has pretty much vanished. But you talk about people who get together, travel great distances to get together and talk about specific Great Books.
Yeah, I was sort of surprised to discover that the Great Books Foundation still exists in Chicago. I wouldn't say it's particularly wealthy. It's not even a nonprofit organization. And they in your part of the country, in my part of the country, they have about 9 regional sectors, I guess they call them, and each of these regions usually has 1 or 2 relatively significant Great Books events. Obviously someone can just Google them immediately. And I went to one New England regional Great Books event, one of the two in New England, and then I went to the annual Great Books event in Chicago. I was just told that'll be attracting 110 people, I guess, this coming May. It's usually held in May, which is a modest number. They tend to be older people. And all I can say is, and it's pretty clear from reading the book, that to attend a weekend-long Great Book seminar is truly an experience like no other.
Now, one of the things that interested me, there were 2 facts that I hadn't heard before, and one was when they were first starting out selling the Great Books, and we're not going to go too much into the background of this. We hope that people have heard some of the earlier programs or might just know on their own what we're talking about. But when the Encyclopedia Britannica first started selling the books door-to-door in the 50s, they did marketing surveys, and one of them was that, I'll just quote you. He says, the Majority of users hailed from the engineering, technical, and service professions and were interested in presenting themselves well in terms of external appearance and behavior. So Benton was right, you say. They were nerds hoping to get a date by yammering about Tolstoy or Lawrence Stern. Except these nerds were really nerdy. And you quote again, the GB owners and prospects are loners or individuals who find the greatest satisfaction in solitary pursuits such as reading. The GB owners and prospects are not people-oriented and show little comprehension of the motivations of others. In fact, they consider people quite disruptive to their lives. But then, a couple of 30 pages later, when you describe the people who go to Great Books meetings these days, you say they're great socializers, and you had no trouble making friends at the bar.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I suppose if you want to split hairs, you could argue that the people who buy these $500 sets, you know, for their personal use, you know, reading in their rec room basement den or whatever, or could be distinguished from the more extroverted people who choose to read three books that are not these, you know, and I do make clear that at the current Great Books events, you know, they're not reading Hippocrates, Galen, you know, hardly even any Plato. They read kind of, it's more modern and it's more sensible. They'll read like one classic, one semi-classic. I remember we read Gulliver's Travels and then Winesburg, Ohio, which I think you could call a semi-classic. Along with Oedipus the King, so it's been updated at least for modern purposes. And yeah, no, those people who go to these various conviviums are themselves quite convivial.
And you mentioned along the way how the program is still going on at the various St. John's, the two St. John's campuses in Maryland and New Mexico. And how the great books have been revised to include authors who were left out before, so it's not entirely dead white males, but it's the revisions that you mentioned are going against the stated aims of the founders.
Yeah, I definitely have a relatively short chapter on the 1990 relaunch of the great books, but that was again, you know, you and I are talking, as I do in the book, about two separate things. You know, on one hand, there's commerce and the attempt basically just to sell a product really to whoever's willing to buy it. And 1990 was certainly in that context, this notion that they could, quote-unquote, update the great books of the Western world, throw in a couple of female writers, and then some excerpts from some more modern stuff. That was a total failure. What's interesting, vaguely, at St. John's College and in the micro curriculum, Yale has a curriculum called Directed Studies. Yeah, I remember I interviewed the lady who runs it, and I said, well, the modern student, you and I are both parents of modern students. I said, does the modern student bridle at all, the fact that there's no women? There's 50 authors on your syllabus and no women? And she says, no, they don't care in the least. So, and St. John's has made very, very few concessions. I hand wave them in the book, but realistically, anyone can go to the internet and see what they teach all 4 years. I mean, they have not really, you know, included people of color. I mean, for any particular reason, they remain quite wedded to the Robert Maynard Hutchins, Mortimer Adler curriculum that was introduced in the middle of the 1930s.
The book's been out for, I guess, about a month now, and it's been widely reviewed, and most of the reviews I've seen have been quite complimentary. The Christian Science Monitor gave it what I guess, I can't tell if this is a compliment or not, but he says you set out to write the opposite of a great book, and you succeeded.
Yeah, several reviewers picked up on that. That's in the end of the introduction, I do say that. I say that I say that I've written the only unboring book ever written about the great books. And I did, at the end of my introduction, I say, you know, I wanted to write a book as distinctly unlike the great books, meaning that I didn't want to write a forbidding tome. I wanted to write something that was quick and that people could get through and learn stuff about. I actually just had a wonderful review in the Washington Monthly that picks up on that. But a lot of reviewers couldn't resist saying that Alex Beam says He did not set out to write a great book, nor did he. But, I mean, but so be it. To be fair, they then go on. And yes, the reviews have been broad and tremendous, and I'm very, very happy.
What are you doing after the reviews? I know you went to the Chicago Humanities Festival a couple of weeks ago, where there was a day devoted to the great books, and I guess they were looking at them in a much more positive way than you did.
Yes, but for whatever reason, the Keepers of the Flame, with one minor exception, but the Great Books Foundation has kind of embraced my book. They've included it in their catalog. They excerpted it in their magazine, which is called Common Review. They're adamant about. I mean, they're very happy the attention's being paid to the great books, and they are modernizers. I mean, they're not stuck in the 1930s in terms of what they read. I shared the stage with actually St. John's College most famous professor, who's mentioned in my book, Eva Braun, and with Earl Shoras, who's done amazing work his entire life. Really, basically, just teaching the great books in grant-funded programs to what we would call less fortunate people. He's taught them in radically different contexts, prison contexts, homeless shelter contexts. There's a guy here in Massachusetts, who just got a MacArthur Award, Dr. Jonathan Shea, for teaching the great books to disturbed war veterans. That's a whole. I only briefly allude to that in my book, but there's a whole sort of ideology out there that sees the great books almost not only as an educational tool, but as a sort of a socioeconomic palliative, so almost having restorative powers. And Shoras is one of the names most closely associated with that.
But here, of course, we have to distinguish between the great books, with the capitals, and great books, period. Toward the end of the book, you talk about how many people get drawn back to the classics one way or another, but they usually do it through other avenues than that big set of 54 volumes.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and again, anybody who reads my book, which can be done fairly quickly, I'm looking at the set as I speak to you, and they're really not worth much. Other than the $200 or $300 they might be physically worth, because they're sort of so off-putting, they're so retrograde. They practically have a sign on them saying "Don't read me." But it is weird. I mean, I was just having lunch with a guy who wants to relaunch Modern Library. Barnes and Noble's has a classic paperbacks called Great Classics. There's a lot of, and one can be cynical and note that many of these great books are in the public domain. But, great books with a small G, small B, play a huge role, because there are, indeed, when Adler and Hutchins set out to choose their books, there are about 18 books in the, I wouldn't say the English canon, but in any case, in the Western canon, the Judeo-Christian canon. There are about 18 books. I don't think I could name them immediately, but certainly the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Bible would be, three gimmies right there. That there is a sort of, I think, a collective belief in, and a shared sense that no matter where our, and maybe I'd be pilloried for saying this, but no matter where our society is, that people should understand. I mean, we could we'd throw in Plato and Aristotle. I mean, at least sort of. Know what the questions that were being asked 3,000 years ago, they're relevant to Jews, they're relevant to Christians, they're relevant to people of almost any religion.
I'm one of the, probably the few people who was, I couldn't quite say disappointed because I didn't even know it happened, but retrospectively disappointed that Apollonius's conic sections were dropped out, because the few volumes I have are mostly of the scientific classics, which I've barely read, but somehow I feel I want to have them in case I ever want to look through how you slice a cone to get a parabola or hyperbola. And there was really only two choices in the past. One was the Dover editions, which were very scholarly, had lots of footnotes, lots of information, and then there were the great books, which had no information whatsoever except the texts, but at least they popped up all over the place. And I've never seen, for instance, the Dover editions of some of these scientific classics.
Well, I'll be happy to send you my copy of Apollonius.
No, I have it. I have it. And I actually, you know, I do look at it periodically, but the thought of reading through it never came close to entering my mind.
Well, there is, as you know, there's this tiny moment in my book where I'm actually in a classroom at St. John's College where Apollonius is being taught, and a student at the blackboard says, "This is the most fascinating stuff I've ever worked with." So, I mean, yeah, it's a kind of a, you know, it's a cabinet of wonders in a way, and they elicit amazingly diverse reactions from different people.
Now, to get back to the nuts and bolts, and I'll just mention to listeners who may be a little puzzled what we're doing, that this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I am Eric Tome, and I'm talking with Alex Beam about his book, A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. And this is the fifth interview we've had on this. The first one was in October of 2006, when you were first getting started. And over the last 2 years, we've discussed the process, who you've talked to, where you've gone, your changing attitude towards some of the people involved. Now you're done. It's published. You've gone to the Chicago Humanities Festival. You've gotten generally good reviews. Are you going on the road to publicize it?
Probably not. I mean, I probably, you know, will answer specific requests. The way it works with the public affairs, which is a very good sort of small mammal type publisher, is that you know, we'll certainly try to do a lot of radio. We may even pay down the line, you know, we may pay someone to drum up more radio interest, but we're doing fine on radio interest so far. So I would do what's called a radio tour. But it's a different kind of economics. This is what is called a mid-list book, which has been the whole public affairs. This one publishing house was sort of created basically to make money off of mid-list publishing. But so the model is different from the sort of Malcolm Gladwell is out there promoting a book right now, and it's, you know, it's hard to turn on a broadcast outlet without hearing from him. But the economics in the middle are very, very different, and money would probably not be spent on touring. Money would not be spent on advertising. You know, money would be spent, hopefully, you know, tactically trying to find out where we can find the people who know the most about the great books and who might enjoy reading this book.
I think that this program, Booktown, probably largely features mid-list titles, and I have no idea whatsoever if being on here has ever helped an author sell a single book.
Probably hasn't hurt any authors.
No, and it's been fun.
Exactly. No, I mean, you know, every author welcomes a chance to talk about their book. I was trying to be, you know, frank with you rather than whorish. I mean, I'm happy to be in your show because you've taken such an interest in my book. But I mean, you never know, really. I mean, one thing for this kind of book that I think helps, because I published a successful nonfiction book in 2001, 2002, is Joe telling Mary that it's a good book. I mean, that really helps, and you can't pay for that.
That one was Gracefully Insane, about the McLean Hospital outside of Boston. Is that still in print?
Yeah, I mean, it is still in print, and it's for that category of book, it's very successful. It's very unusual for a book to be in print 6 years after it was published. I don't have much of a handle on it, except for, you know, the biannual royalty checks I get, which are quite modest. But having published two other books that had much more common trajectories, which were, you know, not going into paperback and going out of print within 18 months, it's neat to have a different kind of existence. And I'm very cautious / paranoid, but I suspect that this book will have a nice life in paperback, frankly. All we really would have to do is plaster these amazing reviews on the cover. I mean, And you know, these are not huge numbers, and it won't be financing a second home, but it's nice, you know, it's nice, and it's a credit to this particular publisher. I mean, they're very happy with modest successes, and so am I.
So how did you connect with them? They did not publish your novel. They don't publish novels.
They don't publish novels. I connected them, you know, really just a year or two after they had been founded. And this young guy, my agent sent them the proposal, and he said, you know, this is a house that never pays a lot of money, but they had just had a curious bestseller. Not many people would figure that this would be a bestseller, and I'm a little bit embarrassed that I've forgotten the name of it, but they had a book by a New York Times copy editor about the shadow submarine war between the United States and the Soviet Union, about how submarines shadow each other underwater and had been doing so for decades. And it was their whole thing is just kind of targeting books that they don't care if they really appear on bestseller lists. I mean, they're just as happy if they do, but they figure they can sell 15,000 and make a tidy profit. That book sold several hundred thousand copies, but I don't know, this young guy, he's now at Little Brown, he was very excited by the McLean book, and they trusted me to write it, and you know, years later, I got feedback from some of these. It was very gratifying to my ego. You know, some editor who's quote-unquote famous said, you know, that just didn't sound like it was going to be that great a book, and then she allowed that it was a great, I mean, small g, small b. So you know, they had confidence in my ability, I guess, and I was grateful. Now in the second book, that they had a very high level of confidence, so that wasn't going to be much of a problem. But anyway, they publish a relatively limited amount of books, and they tend to be good ones.
So, are you going to work with them again? Do you have other plans?
I don't know, Eric. It's really weird. I have an idea for a book that it just seems to me kind of abstruse and non-commercial. And as a guy, I had lunch with a smart guy who sells books for a living. He's the Random House rep. I had lunch with him last week, and he said, you know, don't take this the wrong way, but to the extent that people buy your book, they're going to buy it for the subject matter. They're not going to buy it, you know, because they know who you are. And I sort of get that, and I don't think I can still sort of sell a book, you know, on the strength of my name. I don't know. I haven't even talked to my agent about my next idea, because I'm really fearful that he won't understand it.
So I won't press any farther in that direction, but that leads me to wonder, do you sell more books around Boston, where you're a columnist, or around Annapolis or Chicago, where the Grain books are more in favor?
Yeah, well, my publisher certainly thinks so. I mean, their sense is that they're planning to sell a fair amount of books in New England. That's for sure. They have not targeted Chicago. Not quite sure why. Annapolis, you know, who knows? Who knows? You know, yeah. I mean, I'm being interviewed by the St. John's College Alumni Magazine tomorrow. I mean, that certainly can't hurt. We got a lovely review in the Chicago Tribune, and I have my fingers crossed that that newspaper might revisit the subject. There's some kind of voodoo. There's some kind of dark voodoo that I'm not privy to about. There's sort of hot spots for the quote unquote this kind of book, and I think the hot spots are, you know, they don't. Well, let's put it in a negative way. I don't think the hot spots really include Chicago, and I think it's New York, Boston, Washington to a certain extent, and then again, you know, we would try to reach out to and we have the Great Books Foundation network at our disposal, so you know, that's taken care of, but I think this book will probably sell broadly and shallowly, you know, rather than the McLean book sold very, very well in Boston because it was about a Boston institution, and Chicago, I mean, I'm waiting for Oprah to call. Let me put it that way.
You started out, at least as a book writer, as writing novels, and then you switched to nonfiction, and that seems to be where you're going to stay. Is that a good assumption?
That's pretty fair to say. That's a pretty safe assumption. Are you going to ask me why?
Sure. Why?
It's weird. Somebody asked me that, and it's a question in a sense I've been dying to answer, but I guess the short answer, I think, is that the easy answer, it's much easier to sell a nonfiction book. It's easier to sell the idea to a publisher and get money, and it's easier to sell it to the public. I mean, because I've read not very good nonfiction books on subjects that interest me, and I'm sure that that would apply to you as well. I mean, the perfect match is a beautifully written book on a subject that interests you, but you're willing to settle for an okay book on a subject that interests you. And I guess the flip side of that is I cannot settle for, merely okay fiction, just ain't good enough. And I don't know, at some point this switch got flipped in my brain, and I felt, there are fiction writers I adore and revere, and they're engaging the practice at a level well above mine. Whereas in nonfiction, I'm not frightened. I'm not frightened to compete with anyone. I'm reading a book by a fairly well-known writer, I guess, for the purposes of reviewing it. And I guess there's no nonfiction writer out there, with few exceptions, where I would say, oh, I could never do that. I mean, with time and application, I feel I could do that. Whereas with fiction, it's simply not possible.
Did you ever finish The Secret History?
I never did. I okay. never did.
So that explains that. I'll just tell people that I saw Alex last summer, and I had just finished reading Donna Tartt's The Secret History, which I had mixed feelings about, but whenever I was about to put it down, something would make me pick it up again. But Alex had more discipline, I guess, than I did, and decided to skip it.
Well, I definitely would not characterize that as discipline. I tell you that within moments of putting that down at the Tuftonboro Library, I saw a spine of a book that I thought I had seen reviewed. I pulled it off the shelf. It was called Cost, COST, by Roxana Robinson, and it was the best novel I read all summer. Utterly astonishing, utterly fantastic. So, I once said to a friend of mine, I mean, that fiction writing is the senior service. You know, the British Navy is considered the senior service in the pantheon of the British military, senior to the Air Force, senior to the Army, and I think fiction writing is the senior service. And other than Roxana Robinson, it's when you see it done so well, and tastes vary, of course, but I lack confidence. I wouldn't mind hitting fiction again, especially light fiction, but I've written some other fiction that hasn't been published, but light fiction is, I'm starting to rave, but I did, for instance, read the novel that just won the Booker Award, which is a humorous novel by an Indian author that has the word tiger in it. It's called White Tiger. And it's pretty darn funny, but I don't read too much, humorous American fiction, because sometimes I feel it doesn't come off as being all that funny.
Well, I'm going to have to stop now because I've going to have to talk to somebody else in the second half of the program, and I know that you have to go to a class.
Yes, I have to go brush up on my Spanish.
Yeah. So thanks for seeing us through to the end of A Great Idea at the Time, and let me know when you've decided on a title for the future.
Well, thank you for your interest, Derek. You've been really, really generous, and you've helped me sort out my own thinking for the duration of this project. So thank you again.
Okay. Bye, Alex.
Take care. Thank you.
And this is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. In the second half of the program, I'm going to be talking with Leslie T. Chang, a journalist, longtime writer for the Wall Street Journal, who's just published the book Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. Welcome to Booktown.
Hi, thanks.
This book describes what you call the largest mass migration in human history. What is that?
That's right. Right now in China, roughly 130 million people at last count have moved from rural China to live and work in the big cities, mostly along the coast. And, you know, as with many things in China, the numbers are so large that it's sort of hard to really get a sense of what that means. But, you know, one way to think about that is this is three times the number of people who moved from Europe to America over a century. So these are people who are leaving very traditional, poor villages and at once moving into the most modern, the most advanced, the most, in many cases, the most chaotic parts of Chinese society. So it's a huge transition for them.
And there are many men, but the people you tend to concentrate on are the women who've gone to the factories, especially in the region, the Dongguan region, a little bit north of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And in particular, you concentrate on a very young woman, and I think she's 17 or 18 men, and then an older one who's been in the area for longer. And then you cover many other people peripherally. Mm-hmm. Most of the people, although there have been migrants from both sexes, most of the factory workers are women, it seems.
Yeah, you know, in terms of the total migration, the numbers say maybe between a third and a half are women and the rest are men. I chose to focus on women for a couple of reasons. One, I was very interested in the factory towns and kind of the sociology of these places. And factory owners tend to prefer to hire young women because they feel like they're more diligent and cause less trouble. They don't drink and gamble and get into fights, and, you know, it's one of the many sort of gender stereotypes and divides that you notice living in China. I also thought it would be interesting to focus on women because when they're living in their villages, they're among the most marginalized and the least, you know, the least powerful people because they're young and they're women in a still pretty patriarchal society. But then when they come to the cities, they're suddenly, you know, desired for these factory jobs, and they have total freedom and liberation, and, you know, they're hundreds of miles away from their families and parents. And I was very curious to see whether coming to the city also brought a sense of freedom and adventure, as well as all the tough things about living in the factories that we've already read about.
And one of the things you mentioned is one of the first lessons they learn is to stop paying attention to their parents' advice.
Yeah, that's right. You know, one thing that I found really striking and really poignant about talking to these young women was that they almost immediately realized that the advice their parents were giving them was wrong. And that usually happened when a young woman first came into a factory and then decided that she didn't like the work and she wanted to find another factory. This happened to the young woman, Min, who I write about. So she called home and she told her parents that she was thinking of quitting her job and going to another factory. And her parents were like, oh, don't do that. You already have a job. You know, keep that job. Because to them, a job is just a job. You know, they don't have any sense that there are different jobs with better pay, better conditions, better opportunities for moving up. So, you know, that's one of the really poignant things I thought about these young women is while they're learning to navigate their job situation and their dating situation and their living situation in the city, they're also growing up at the same time and realizing that their parents really don't have the answers for them.
And when Min made this decision, she was 17, 18?
Yeah, it was pretty typical among, you know, I got to know Min and another woman, Chunming, the best, and sort of followed them for 2 years, but I got to know a large number of women and heard their stories. And it was very typical to come out from the village and immediately get a job through, you know, a friend or a villager or cousin who would introduce them into a factory, and then quite soon after that to decide to jump to another factory, because when they go into the factory, they have no knowledge about anything. But then once they go in, they start hearing, oh, this factory pays better, this one has nicer bosses, this one has more time off or less time off, depending on what you're looking for. So it's very common to see a first job situation be really, really tough and then to gradually move up into better circumstances.
When they start out, they usually are living in dormitories and sending almost all their money home.
That's right. Yeah, living in dormitories was a pretty common thing among, you know, basically unmarried factory workers would live in dorms. And a lot of them chose to live there because they felt like it was, or not chose, they preferred to live there because they felt like it was safer to live inside a factory compound, which often had walls and guards at the gates, rather than to live out in the city, where things are often quite chaotic and there's a lot of petty crime. But what often happened was, you know, after these young women work in the factories for a couple of years, they might have a boyfriend, and then they'll often decide to move out and rent an apartment, you know, right in the factory zone, but not inside the factory gates, and live there either unmarried or married. That's one of the many ways in which there's a lot of freedom for these young people doing things they never could have imagined doing if they were still living in the village.
Now, men seem to have a much clearer idea of what she wanted to do than many of the women, and she actually, toward the end of your first section, you're saying she was right on track with her plans.
Yeah, she was. You know, I was interested in her because she had a pretty typical background. You know, she came from a poor farming village. She had younger siblings who were still in school, so she had a lot of pressures to provide for her family. But and she'd gone to middle school and a little bit of vocational high school, which was not a typical educational background. But one thing that really drew me to her was I felt like she was just very talkative, very spirited, very resourceful. And while these qualities are actually pretty common among people in China, people are generally very pragmatic and trying really hard to get ahead. I did find that Min was very appealing personally, and that's one reason that I decided to stick with her and write about her.
The other woman, Chun Ming, you only covered part of her career, but she'd been working in the factories for a dozen years when you got to know her.
That's right. I was curious what life was like for an older woman, which in a city of these teenage factory workers basically means anyone over the age of 30. And so I wanted to know what it was like to be an older woman who had worked in the city a number of years, was not married, maybe had a lot of pressures from home, but was also enjoying her freedom. So I actually discovered that in the city of Dongguan, where I focused my reporting in South China, there were a bunch of different dating agencies. And so I went and visited one of the dating agencies. And you know, it was one of these interesting things where these ideas from the West are imported, but they're often kind of distorted or reworked to suit Chinese conditions. And in this case, you know, people did not call up strangers to go out on dates after seeing their profile in a dating book because they were so shy and so modest. So instead, the club had this Sunday afternoon meeting where they would invite, you know, all the members to come, and they could kind of mingle and introduce themselves and hopefully hook up and get to know each other that way. So I met Chun Ming at one of these kind of group dating sessions, and again, she appealed to me because she was very talkative, very open, and very curious about me. And, you know, one of the things I learned about reporting the factory world is that the big challenge is staying in touch with people because they're so mobile, they'll switch jobs so quickly. Often their own friends and parents can't keep track of where they are. So unless you find people who are also curious about you and want to keep in touch with you, you're going to lose touch with them very quickly. And I lost touch with a great number of people. And initially it was quite traumatic because I would get to know them and sort of feel like, oh, they're really interesting and I want to learn about their stories, and then they would just disappear and I would never find them again.
Your two main characters, although they both started as factory girls, they still live in the factory city, they are not really employed in the factories anymore. This is rather atypical. I think most of the people you mention sometimes expect to spend anywhere from 6 to 12 years in the factories.
I wouldn't say it's atypical. You know, I think there are... one thing that struck me about the factory world was the immense social mobility. And most of the people, all of the people that I met in the factory world, from high-level executives to mid-level, you know, technicians to low-level production, you know, bosses on the factory line, almost all of them started out as regular assembly line workers. And that's one of the things I explore in the book, is how people move up. And for young women, it's actually, my sense was that there's more mobility than for young men. because if they worked on the factory floor and then got a little training, you know, on the side, taking night classes to learn how to use the computer or learn a little bit of English or a little bit of accounting or whatever, they could kind of work their way into a job as a secretary or a clerk, kind of the lowest level white-collar job. Still in the factory, you know, they're still working for a factory, but they're working in the office rather than on the assembly line. And then from there, they could move up into generally into sales or marketing positions and go up from there.
And these office positions were not available for men?
Interestingly, you know, there was just such specific gender divides in the factory world. And, you know, as I mentioned, on the assembly line, they wanted young women. But certain jobs that required more physical strength, they would only want men. But then for, like, these kind of low-level office jobs, like clerks and secretaries, you know, they would only want women for those jobs. While for, you know, drivers or security guards, they would only want men for those jobs and cooks, you know. So it seems very strange to us as Westerners, because a lot of these jobs could be done just as well by either sex, but that's how the bosses wanted it. So what that ended up meaning was that I felt like for the young women, there was actually more social mobility at the lower levels of jobs to move up from the lowest level into something slightly higher.
We've been talking abstractly about the factories, but what are these factories?
They're basically anything from a factory that's, you know, a few dozen workers in an apartment building sewing pieces of inner soles that go into a shoe, to a factory that I profile in one chapter in my book, which employs 75,000 people, one of the largest factories in the country, making Nike, Reebok, Adidas shoes for, you know, American clients. And these are basically all, from the smallest to the largest, they're making, you know, computer, laptop parts, mobile phone parts, clothing, shoes, plastic goods, you know, all things that you can find, you know, in a typical Walmart or Hallmark or, you know, any number of stores that we shop at every day in America.
In this factory that you're just talking about, the Yuen plant, you say it's, imagine the entire population of Santa Fe, New Mexico, under the age of 30 and engaged in making athletic shoes. And apparently they, in this one factory, they make shoes for all the brands you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Which I would think would be rather strange, and you say they even designed them.
Yeah, this factory had been working with these big American clients for many years, so they had developed pretty, you know, dependable and sophisticated working relationship with their clients. So basically, you know, the customer, like Nike, would come to them and say, we want this kind of shoe and, you know, this price range and this style, and then the Yuen factory's designers would go and create a sample and then come back to Nike and say, is this what you want? And then they kind of go back and forth. Obviously, Nike has a huge number of, you know, huge team of their own designers, but they would work with the factory to actually make the sample shoes, and then when they were happy with the samples, then they'd go on and produce it in larger quantities. So, yeah, it's an interesting relationship because, you know, so many of the companies at this point, that the brands that we know really well, they don't actually make their product anymore. Their product is made by a nameless factory in China. But then the company, the brand we know, does the inspections and the sales and the marketing and the advertising and creates this, you know, sells this product. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to write about these factories is, you know, these are these factories you've never heard of that are making all these products that you use every day.
And companies like Nike came under a lot of attack, a dozen years ago, for the factory working conditions, and they have taken some steps to improve them, and not all the workers are happy to be working shorter hours.
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting things is, as you mentioned, kind of in the early to mid-90s, a lot of these companies like Nike and Adidas and later companies like The Gap and Liz Claiborne, they all sort of started giving more pressure to their Chinese suppliers to have better working conditions for their employees, you know, have Monday off, only work 12 or 14 hours a day, which sounds like a lot to us, but is actually a lot lower than what they were used to working. And, you know, when I spoke to the Yuen Shoe Factory, they said when they implemented a lot of these changes in 1998, a lot of the workers left because they said, I'm here to work 7 days a week. I don't want a day off. I have nothing to do. You know, I want to make as much money as possible so I can send it home, or I can build a new house in the village or whatever. So it's sort of interesting how, you know, what were indisputably good intentions on the part of the American buyers sort of play out in unusual and surprising ways, often inside the factory town.
So many of the workers send their money home and then hope to return home, as you said, and build a nice house. How many of them actually do that, and how many of them stay in the factories?
Yeah, I think that's changing. You know, this migration phenomenon in China probably started in the early 80s, and my sense was that that early generation of migrant workers were much more tied to the farm. They would often go home for the planting, for the spring planting, and again for the fall harvest, and their eventual goal was to make enough money so they could go back home, build a nice house or renovate a house for their family, and then marry and live there on the farm. But, you know, what people are finding, what scholars are finding, is that this newer generation of migrant workers who've come out, say, in the last 5 to 10 years, their expectations are different. You know, they're much more attuned to the pleasures and attractions of the city, and they really want to stay in the city. So my sense is, you know, among the both women I write about, they're not going to go home to their rural villages. They're not going to become farmers. I think if they're more successful, they will end up living in Dongguan, eventually marrying and getting an apartment and just living, becoming urban people. And less successful, I think they would probably move back to a town or a small city near their village and maybe set up some kind of small-scale business there. So I just don't think farming is in their future. And one reason is that they've never actually been farmers. You know, they've gone to elementary school and middle school and then come out to work at the age of 16. So even if they wanted to work on the farm, they wouldn't even know what to do. So it's basically the older generation that's now kind of keeping the family farm going.
The stories of the factory girls would be fascinating enough, but you interlace them with your personal history and then your family history. I guess your great-great-great grandparents were involved in the second largest mass migration in Chinese history.
Yeah, I wanted to... Well, it started kind of serendipitously. I was on book leave from the Wall Street Journal to work on this factory, you know, factory town project, and so I decided to visit my ancestral village that my grandfather had actually come out of to go to school as a teenager when he was 16 years old. And so this was a village in northeastern China, so very different from these South China factory areas I'd been reporting on. But as I got to know more about my family history and my grandfather's coming out from home and sort of discovering the wide world and figuring out his place in it, I saw that there were parallel narratives between his family story and the story of these young migrants. And, you know, one of the things that strikes you being in a factory town like Dongguan is there's almost no sense of history, because these towns kind of sprang up overnight, and these young people don't really have a sense of the past, and sort of like every day is lived day by day, and people rarely even take stock of their own past, you know, what's happened to them since they come out to the city. So I wanted to have a different thread that sort of reflected more the deep sense of history and the burdens of the past that I feel like are still present in Chinese society among Chinese people. And so I felt like this family story was the way to do that.
Yeah, the Chinese have such a deep sense of family history and surname history and mm-hmm. regional history. Although your ancestors, when they moved into Manchuria, they eventually set up their ancestral tablets in Manchuria, and sort of their family history began with their move.
Exactly.
And didn't include the time when they'd been in China proper.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that was one of the things I found really fascinating was, as you mentioned, the Chinese have this long history of keeping their genealogies. This tradition goes back, you know, more than 1,000 years. And so I started looking into this kind of genealogy, you know, the system of keeping a genealogy, and what I found was that the first ancestor in anyone's genealogy was the person who migrated from wherever place the family came from before to this new place where all his descendants eventually settled and lived. And so it's really interesting. You think of the genealogy as a sort of timeless thing moving back into history, and instead it's tied to this migration, you know, which we think of as very mobile, very fluid, very modern kind of phenomenon. So I thought that would be a really nice interplay, you know, the sense of family history also starting with migration, even though it happened, you know, in my family's case, you know, more than 200 years ago when my family moved to Manchuria.
And so 100 years from now, Dongguan may be the foundation of thousands of family histories.
Yeah, that would be something. Well, one of the interesting things about Dongguan was, you know, I thought of it as a place that had no history, and then when I started doing a little reading, I found that, you know, a lot of the key battles of the Opium War in the middle of the 19th century actually took place in Dongguan. So this was actually a place with quite a lot of very resonant, important modern history for China. But the fact is, you know, no one I ever met in the city mentioned this to me. For them, that was like the furthest concern from their mind. You know, it was like the history of this place. All they cared about was, you know, where am I working? How can I improve my life? You know, was purely focused on what the city could do for them.
This is Booktown on KPMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Leslie T. Chang, author of Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. Thanks so much for coming on, and I've now got to get off and make way for the next program.
Okay, thank you very much.
And as I said, this has been Booktown on KPMR-FM in Nevada City. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.